at the end of the day, it is also what other things should we be doing to get our story out? And that would be on the own channel. There's always the sort of three buckets, right, of earned, which is press, the paid sort of traditional advertising, if you will, and then the own channels. And so what we're really, what we've built over time, what we're really spending a lot of time on now is sort of what is it that we could do telling our own, you know, owning our own stories, and where do our customers need to see them, you know, investors, you know, employees, possible recruits, whatever the audience is that are important to our companies that we work with. Let's work on that, because you can't rely solely on just telling it through the media. It's not that you can't, but it's just, you can't, it's not your sole channel anymore. It's really hard.
Thanks for pressing play. Legends and Losers is sponsored by GrowWire.com. Learn how to grow your business and yourself at GrowWire.com. Today we have an amazing guest, Alex Constantinople. She is the CEO of Outkast, and she's just one of these people having one of those amazing careers. She, early in her career, worked for Larry King and has made it today to being the CEO of one of the top technology, PR, and communication firms on the planet. We have a great conversation that I know you'll enjoy about how she took over from two iconic founders, how you can be a media-savvy business world, particularly in a world where there's no such thing as a private or internal communication, and what all leaders need to know about the modern media landscape.
Hello, my legendary friends. This is Legends and Losers, the show for people who like to eavesdrop on killer dialogues, brilliant rants, and crazy diversions, straight up with a business twist. Hosted by Christopher Lockhead, former three-time CMO and co-author of Play Bigger, who has one of the most strategic minds in marketing, but could also hide his own Easter eggs. And now, strap yourselves in. It's time for Legends and Losers.
All right, all right, all right. Hey ho, let's go. Hello, my legendary friends. Thank you so much for joining me for this fantastic episode of Legends and Losers. If you're a longtime listener, thank you from the bottom of my heart. And if you're new, welcome. We are one of the very few business podcasts that is a free range, real dialogue. Our goal is to capture conversations that matter, conversations that are fun, and most importantly, conversations that you think are sharing. And our name comes from the simple fact that we all learn more from losing than we do from winning, and that legend and loser are two sides of the exact same coin. Now, are you someone who wants to grow yourself or your business? Is it time to get growing? Why not check out GrowWire.com? This is a great new digital property for entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial people with stories of innovation and growth. There's a great podcast called Grow Wire, hosted by my buddy, the uncomparable or incomparable, uncomparable, whichever it is, Jason Maynard. There's the Grow Show on YouTube. And regardless of how you want to consume and what you want to consume, whether it's video or audio or the published word, GrowWire.com is the place for you. Heather Clancy and I have been blogging on a regular basis for GrowWire. There's excerpts of our new book, Niche Down, as well as content. We didn't include Niche Down. You know, if you're going to have a podcast, you should learn how to talk. Anyway, there's a lot of legendary content. Been writing a lot of fun stuff for GrowWire. There's an article up there about a restaurant I heard about a little while ago from my wife called the Sushi Rito. That's a fun one. And lots of other cool stuff. There's a special section for innovative women and lots to check out. So bookmark it today, growwire.com. All right, now here she is, my conversation with the legendary Alex Constantinople.
Well, my first job out of college was where I worked for Larry King. And so that whole sort of, that was the on-air and radio, you know, precursor to all this. And I love that format.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about Larry was he interrupted like crazy. He was far from a traditional interviewer.
Exactly. It was a conversation. It was like you're hanging in Aiden Allen's in LA with him or something, you know?
So what was it like, your first job out of college working for Larry King?
It was fascinating. I really can't even believe they hired me to this day. You know, I was 22 years old. I had a good resume. I had definitely worked every summer, you know, since eighth grade. And I went in to actually be an intern at CNN in their Washington office. And then they called me 2 months later and I hadn't heard anything. And they said, you know, would you want to work for Larry? And this was right before, this is dating me, Ross Perot, and had announced on a show that he was going to run for president. And so it was 3 months of sort of, he had his USA Today column. If you remember, it was like the king of ellipses. It was like, you know, what about the Red Sox? Dot, 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 you know, and, you know, had a great steak last night, dot, dot, dot. And then the radio show, and then he was the primetime winner on, you know, on CNN. And so, I really hit the ground running and I loved my job. And they were like, look, we don't have a publicist here for him and we think you could do it. And I was like, really? So I went through the interview process, interviewed with him, and then I did it for 2 years. And it was, and then Ross Perot, about 3 months later, as I said, came on and said he'd run for president if enough people slipped $5 under his hotel room door, and off we went. And I literally found myself negotiating with 60 Minutes. And, you know, we did not say no. So I learned a valuable lesson of he did anything that we asked of him. And there was, I had no filter of like, we should hold him back a little bit. It was just like, we did everything. So it was a blast through the 92 election. And I loved my experience. And then I was done, moved on.
I love that you were there then. I remember it so vividly. And the thing I loved the most, because he came on all the time, as I remember.
Yeah.
It felt like he was on every other night for a while.
That's how he kind of ran his campaign.
And when he would come on with those classic old school IBM sales guy flip charts, right? Yes. And he would do that. See this graph here, Larry? It's going in the wrong direction. I thought that stuff was awesome.
No, he was so – if you remember, I mean, he really – I mean, I think, 18%? I can't remember. But he really did well, and he really resonated with people. And if you think about – you know, again, I know we're not going into politics, but anyway, it was a very interesting time. And Larry was really – he was very good at that. He could really move from celebrities to, you know, politicians to a businessman to, you know, everyday people. And he had a way, which I thought – you know, I try to use now, which is really to make people very comfortable, forget kind of what you're doing, forget that there's anybody out there. And he would just kind of like sit on his haunches and just ask a ton of questions and get so much. He never prepared, which really bugged traditional journalists because he got a lot of newsmakers. I mean, I've sat there with Yasser Arafat and Robert McNamara. I mean, everybody who kind of came through town, he would get. So it was a great, great learning for me, for sure.
And what are your big, as you reflect on it, what are your big takeaways from the things you learned from that time and from him?
I learned how to hustle. I learned how to be really a personal counselor, you know, and how to take it. I had really hard bosses and, you know, who were very exacting, and I was fired hilariously at night. They would sort of, you know, you're fired. You couldn't get, you know, it's CNN's Larry King Live, you know, in the New York Times or whatever. And I'd go, okay, I don't have control over that. But it was always kind of not real, but it was definitely tough. Like I cried a lot. It was, you know, it was my very first job. It was 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. And I would come up. It was a perfect job for when you're, you know, just starting because you're exhausted and you're supposed to be running, you know, burning the candle at both ends. And that's kind of how it was. So I just sort of learned what I liked and didn't like. Actually, I think I got a lot of how I wanted to lead from that. Sometimes your hardest experiences are what inform you, you know. And then, quite frankly, I learned, and then I moved on from that to go to work at NBC. But I learned that in order to represent somebody, you really have to have a very deep respect and feel like you can, you know, everything and they're truthful with you and all the rest. So I'll leave it at that, but I left 2 years later.
And, you know, today as a running one of the most important agencies in tech and, you know, I certainly want to get a big update from you on how things are going at Outkast.
Yeah.
But what is it about? I mean, right out of the shoot, you're the PR rep for arguably one of the highest profile people in America, if not the world at the time, in your first job.
I know. This is sort of where I sort of have fallen into that. I didn't do a lot of, you know, communications or PR work ahead of that. I was, you know,
Were you a history major? Am I remembering that?
No, I was English literature. And I honestly, I think it is, I mean, communications and being conversant, it's something I work with my kids on all the time. Like, that to me is such a skill. I do feel like I had that early, of being able to talk to adults, being able to, you know, I had confidence and composure to do that. So I could fake it till you make it, I think, is the best way to think about it when you're in there literally with Mike Wallace. I mean, that was who they assigned me, and his producers, his famous producers, Paul and Holly Fine, were, to this day, I remember, just really lovely to work with and patient. And I don't think I presented as a 22-year-old. You know, I had my little suits on and my bag and my hose. It's very DC. And so I think I always, when I was 8 years old, I played office. You know, I had a fantastic mom who ran her own company, and a lot of strong women in my family who ran businesses and did things. And so I always would play imaginary office. And I feel like when I got to that job, I was like, wow, I know how to do this. And I just sort of would be like, okay, let's do this. And it was just that boss part of it that I just channeled, and I went with it. And I tried to always, when I cried or felt very insecure or whatever, I just, you know, which I, of course I had those moments, I just sort of, they were on my own time, and I tried to present a very outwardly strong, I got this vibe.
So you were a very formidable 22-year-old.
I hope so. Yes, I think so. But also, you know, I learned very quickly, and it's all, you know, this whole, you know, that it's all relationships. And so I think because I do feel like I can put people at ease very quickly, you know, having those reporter relationships and with executives as well, and higher ups in the company and people like that, that were very interested in knowing what was going on with us at the time, you know, to be able to make them, you know, just ask them about, you know, so, you know, what are you up to this weekend? You know, all those dumb things that you think are just so I would get kind of ease into it and get to know them well as people. And that also helped, I think, as I kind of went around. It was another great lesson for going forward.
So treat people like people, get to know them like people, and take care.
Yes, yes. And then you can be real. I mean, the more real you are, the faster, you know, you can just be on your way.
But maybe not so much now, but... Yeah, you know, I sort of got taught, or was certainly given the impression, that you had to behave like a professional. You had to, you know, I when I first started in business, I acted like what I thought a business person or an executive should be, right? Because I had no fucking idea, and I thought you had to be a particular way, and I was none of the things that anybody, you know, background wise or any of that. So I tried to overcompensate by looking the part and acting the part and all that. And this whole separation of business and personal and all that shit we get sold. And
yes.
But it sounds like you didn't buy into that shit.
Well, I'm going to own this. In the beginning, I was just me. I didn't know anything. So I just did it. And it was moving so fast. I mean, my head was spinning, and so fast forward, what you're speaking of really happened to me in my GE corporate life. So after I left NBC, which was after CNN, I went up to corporate headquarters and worked for them for almost four plus years. And that experience of being very corporate, NBC was sort of this, GE owned them at the time. It was this creative, their creative, it was in a bubble. So it was still a very different kind of business in the GE portfolio. And as they would trickle down certain things, you know, they'd make sure that they were very thoughtful on how it came, unless you were in finance, obviously, you know, how it came through to an NBC employee. So I was sort of immune to the very corporate headquarter scene of a big, you know, multinational company. And until I got there, and then I think I did play exactly what you said, which was, do I have kids? Nope. I don't know what you're talking about. You know, yeah, I'll go to that meeting at 6 a.m. and, you know, travel. I signed up for everything. And I every PowerPoint presentation, and I swear too, which I love that you do. So I am a big swearer. And so I really didn't realize how exhausted it was to try to be that corporate executive until I left there.
It's fucking exhausting.
It's exhausting. Because even I remember HR spoke to me, because I weren't even like that open. I mean, they weren't like, you know, claw. I don't even know. I had like open toed shoes where like just my little toe was peeping out, and I was spoken to. I had a leather skirt once that was kind of down to my knee, and I was spoken to, you know, I just things like that too. I was like, so they're much better.
Does that happen anymore?
I don't think that's what I'm saying. I think they're much better. I think it was a time and a place, and it was kind of coming out after a certain, you know, one era of a CEO into a new one, and it changed a lot over time. But when I got there, it was very much in that beginning of that transition, and it just needed, it did change over time. But anyway, I mean, regardless. It's
like people wear beachwear to the office today.
I know. I still don't think it happens. Every time I go back, you know, to New York, which we have an office, and I go back often, and I have to be game on in my even my business casual, because, you know, it's just, it is different there. But yes, here we still have to have our little code here just in case. But yeah, business, I mean, I still can't believe sometimes I can go to the office looking like this. I still have my like twitch from my corporate days.
Well, remember when Casual Friday came out and everybody got excited about that?
I know. When we first moved here, it'll be 12 years this fall. My husband, we worked together at NBC, and which is, you know, still very professional. And he showed up his first days of Google, and he came home and he was like, I got to get some real business casual. Like, he was showing up in his version of business casual. And he was like, no, this is not cutting it. Like a huge dork. I have to get like a hoodie and my jeans. And I was like, okay, let's go. So yeah, I hear you.
Well, and even sometimes, you know, my business casual uniform is a pair of nice jeans.
Yes.
Nice shoes, a shirt, and a blazer, yep. Right? And
right.
A lot of us guys have sort of landed there. But yeah. And I don't go to that many meetings anymore. But if I go particularly to an early stage, very techie kind of startup, I find I can't even wear that anymore because it's the equivalent of wearing a three-piece suit to the meeting.
Yeah, it's true. It is so all relative, right? I agree. I'm very conscious of that, depending on if I go to, you know, one of our corporate clients or whether you're showing up in the garage. You know, it's I definitely try to not look like the corporate weenie girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, it seems like even in the last 2 or 3 years, Alex, so much has changed in the media landscape. Mm. Tell me about PR today.
Yeah. It's interesting. We just put together a presentation because it's evolving so quickly. And I know it's the almost tritest thing to say in terms of the speed of which we know business is moving. And so the media landscape, obviously with what went, you know, coupled with politics and what's going on there, what we've seen is a shift where just to get the attention, the normal ways we would get attention of reporters, right, is sort of, there's a playbook. It's, we have a product announcement, I have a company launch, I have this incremental new button on my thingy, and that would get attention. You know, executive comings and goings, and the press just...
Fundraising.
You know, fundraising, you know, the bar for that now. I mean, we were just over at Bloomberg the other day, and, you know, I mean, it's just, you have to have a really big number to get, you know, ink like that. So anyway, the landscape has definitely evolved, but it really has gone a little even faster since, 2016. And I think it is because they are so pushed. One, obviously the media industry is changing themselves and what they all have to produce and do. And so, that's one factor. I think because every day is a crisis in some level, or there's a lot of news to cover, they get pulled very quickly. And so their editors...
there is more news today.
There is more news today that's, you know, where sort of it makes a minor-ish tech announcement or industry thing on our side not be worth covering for them, you know, because they're spending so much time and attention, rightly or wrongly so, on other things that are going on in the world.
Other things, I mean, it feels like, and of course, I don't really want to have political conversation.
I know, I'm trying hard.
No, but I think we can talk about what's going on without sort of getting into, you know,
do we like it or not?
Do you agree with what's going on?
But yeah.
The volume of communication, just having a president that is likely to tweet 2 or 3 times a day or more. I mean, did Obama tweet that much?
I mean, if he did, it was very, and I haven't looked at the volume. I don't think so on the volume, but it was more innocuous, right? It didn't create news in and of itself. And so that's...
So there's a volume coming out of D.C. that is unprecedented. Yeah. Is that true?
For sure.
Okay. So,
and I think if you
experience, that's the way.
No, and I think if you, I highly recommend, which I've been telling some people for sure that I around here for there's a Fourth Estate. There's a fantastic documentary which I will disclose. My sister is I was a story producer on, but it's a behind the scenes of the New York Times and Showtime. just ran it. It's four episodes. It's fantastic. And it really gives you a very good window of what everybody's up against and how they're dealing with it. And that's just the New York Times, obviously. But we hear this every day. You know, my editor, you know, I can't get to that. And lots of stories of like, that's interesting. I'd love to sink my teeth into that. But that, you know, there's not an urgency to it. There's not a hook to it. So, you know, come back to me in a month or so. We're super jammed here. And that's what we were getting more and more of. So what our job is, and this is really why I joined Outkast now 8 years ago, was this, the vision of that media is still a very important part of it, but that we could not be just a PR shop, right? And if you think of PR as media, which I know it's many things, but as really being really good communicators and working with our clients on that, at the end of the day, it is also what other things should we be doing to get our story out? And that would be on the own channel. There's always the sort of three buckets, right, of earned, which is press, the paid sort of traditional advertising, if you will, and then the own channels. And so what we're really, what we've built over time and what we're really spending a lot of time on now is sort of what is it that we could do telling our own, you know, owning our own stories and where do our customers need to see them, you know, investors, you know, employees, possible recruits, whatever the audience is that are important to our companies that we work with. Let's work on that because you can't rely solely on just telling it through the media. It's not that you can't, but it's just, you can't, it's not your sole channel anymore. It's really hard.
Well, and on the earn side, and I don't necessarily want to throw anybody in particular under the bus, but you know, I've done a lot of blogging and writing over the years. And
yeah.
I've written for Forbes and I've written for Fortune.
Yeah.
And I wrote for CBS News for a while when Dan Farber was there. That was really fun. You know, and my work's been in HBR, and you know, I've had exposure to these,
yeah,
you know, pretty big platforms. And let me say it this way: you could put something on Quora that has, like, I don't know how to measure it, Alex, but like meaningful more impact. Like, I would write for one of those, let's just say, and fucking nothing. Suddenly, nothing
yeah.
happened.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
you wouldn't pick up two Twitter followers. Like, it was like,
yes.
and I'm talking about big ass brands where at a cocktail party you say, well, I blog for, you know, so and so. They, back when that was impressive, people would
yeah.
go, oh, you know, you must be a very big ding dong person because you blog for fill in the blank big publication.
Right.
And nothing ever happened. And something on Quora or Medium or my own podcast is like, way more impactful, has way more reach. And so I guess my question is, do people still read this shit?
Well, that's, to me, it is that's the whole pie you do have to look at. And as I had a wonderful coffee yesterday with an author, and she was giving me her best practices of what she just learned. And it's so different even than talking to an author of a business book, let's say, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. And really, actually, it's interesting for two examples that I know of authors, let's just take that, who are kind of in the space, thought leaders. So they have brands going into selling their books. Podcasts were Kevin Kelly actually wrote about this. Podcasts singularly were the thing that drove book sales. And he believes got him on the bestseller list. And he just blocked out 2 days, I believe it was. And I'm sorry if I'm messing up some of the details, but it basically, he just cranked out back-to-back-to-back-to-back podcasts and really didn't do a ton more else. And I think he obviously probably got some reviews and some things, but even the playbook for that has changed. And I think the more niche that people are getting and the more targeted they are on their audiences, really understanding where their audiences are, that upfront work to know that and then go after them that way is going to be a lot easier. Like, look, a New York Times cover of business section or a huge story, like, you know, in a magazine that might have your readers, maybe still drives sales if you're a consumer product company, but it's really hard to measure and know these days because there is just so much. So the micro targeting, I think, is really important for people to get used to because that is what you have to do. And it won't feel big. You know, you won't feel like, oh, I'm on the Today Show and that drove my, you know, sales or my book. And sometimes it does work, but you kind of, for our clients, especially in the consumer space, they really have to put all guns barreling against, you know, an ad by doing some media, still some big media, and then going after and having a whole content push. And they have to do all of it or else they kind of just, you know, don't see the results, which is, it's a lot of work.
Yeah. And it's interesting what you said about podcasts. You know, I mean, I have my second book coming out soon here.
Yeah.
And we did all the traditional things in the launch of Play Bigger, my first book. And mm-hmm. we hired the PR firm that, you know, our publisher told us to hire. And, you know, we did all that stuff. And it was helpful for sure.
Yeah.
But it didn't take off until my ass started doing podcasts.
Right. I mean, no, I'm telling you, this is the thing. Yes, sure.
But I kept expecting, you know, we had some high impact things that went down when Play Bigger came out. And I kept expecting that you'd see a correlation. I knew it was word of mouth. I knew who the VCs were who were buying 500 copies each because I could see it. Yeah. And they were emailing me saying, how do I get this done? And so I knew what those were, right? But it was really going on podcasts and starting Legends and Losers that did it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, even something like, you know, being a New York Times bestseller, I don't know that let me say it this way. As a soon-to-be second-time author, I don't give a shit about that. It would be nice. It would be nice, sure. Yeah. But it's not like the thing, like the holy grail that if you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have said, well, we're going to try to, you know, bend over backwards to make that happen.
Well, it's interesting. The same woman that I was having coffee with yesterday, she said, you know, she went abroad to a European country for like a speaking op for her book. And she just said, gosh, here I am. It's 5 days out of my life. I'm not, you know, that's not going to be a value. She didn't sell any books. I mean, it was great. You know, it's always somebody you meet and it's lovely and all the rest. But at the end of the day, she's like, here's what I'm going to do for the fall. You know, and she was just very specific. She really did the analysis of what was working, what's not. She'll do web stuff like this. She'll do podcasts that she can be, you know, at her desk. And then it has to have a certain threshold if she's going to travel, you know, and paid, right? You know, for your time, if you really think of that. So it's I think the thoughtfulness that needs to go into everything, which is why I feel good about working here, is sort of the strategy and the upfront work and being smart and thoughtful and pushing back on, you know, recommendations. You know, if a client's like, yeah, I just want, you know, to go the old, like, just get me in Fortune. You're like, you know what? No. And here's why. I just think that will be more and more important. And we have some clients who just don't even, the PR is just, the media side is just not even what they're after, right? It's just, I want to do storytelling this way, through visual, through social, through, you know, digital appearances, a conference. I mean, we've even have one client on the B2B side who we've created a magazine for them, like an old school magazine, and they send it to customers and they found it really effective. And so you just have to kind of get creative. It doesn't mean that old things don't work. It just, you have to really think about who it is that you're trying to reach and what will move the needle for your business. I mean, it's just otherwise the sort of brand stuff, the wild, crazy brand stuff for brand stuff. Everything that I kind of watch Ken and what goes on in there, like over here on my left side, I'm always just curious, having worked with ad agencies and stuff in my past. And there's just such a reckoning coming with all this, you know? So we'll see where it all shakes out, but it's a really interesting time. And the most important thing that we always tell our clients is what is it that you are trying to say? So it really goes back to the absolutely simplest thing of what are the words you're using to talk about your company, to talk about what it is that you're doing and why and all the rest, and just kind of nail that. And then let's figure out where to put it.
Huh? So you start with what the point of view is.
Messaging.
What's the conversation we want to have?
Absolutely. You have to. And it's hard because there are some clients that will send, you know, I want to get involved in this conversation, or I want to spark controversy over here, and just entering into that for the entering into its sake is not, you know, I hate sounding like, you know, Miss Dr. Knows all the time, but I do feel like that's again, those are little bursts, you know, but they're not a long-term gain of getting the right attention from the right people, you know, that will, to your point, is that worth the effort that you're putting into it? Are you going to get back what you put out there?
How do we gain attention in the world of, you know, Kardashian ass selfies and nonstop political news and this massive fragmentation that's now happened. And so if let's say I'm the CMO or the CEO of a new client of yours, and we're sitting, you know, we've done the dance, we signed the contract, and we're now going to sit down and have the first conversation about what they're, you know, how we be successful together, if that's even a sentence. How we be successful. What do you say to me if I'm that CEO or that CMO?
Well, I mean, our general rule is to always start with what their business goals are. We never really ask what their marketing plan is or their PR plan right off. It really has, you have to understand. And interestingly enough, sometimes they don't even know. And you go, okay, duly noted, let's go back and really make sure that we understand where the business is going and how the business is measuring itself. And then what could be a marketing plan. So what's needed? Sometimes if we have one client who already knows their customers, there's a very certain subset of 100 customers in the whole world that's going to buy their thing, and they don't need help finding them and going to them, right? It's a different kind of, they have no funnel issues or pipeline issues. So it really is about what is needed, how to differentiate yourself next to a competitor, you know, and what, where are they and how do we reach them? And then there's the sort of clients that are in the category of big consumer brands. And usually we enter into relationships with them with a very specific task, which is we have an innovation story to tell. I know that word is very overused. Or we want to be relevant and stay relevant. How do we do that? So it really, it depends. Again, I wish there was an easy answer to this question, but everything is so unique, which makes our end hard, because there isn't sort of like, you can buy option package 2 or 1, you know, it's everything feels very bespoke, even though, you know, you're pulling from a lot of stuff you've done, over time for different people, but everybody has a very interesting, so it really depends on what the issue that they are coming to us to help them with, and then we kind of build.
I mean, startups wanted PR to drive funnel, to drive pipeline and sales.
Yes, yes.
Is that less true today?
So that's a thank you for that group, the startups. It is still very much, we need to be on the map. So get us, you know. So it's launching companies from stealth. It is making sure people know that we exist and what we're doing. And so that is a more tried and true. You know, that hasn't changed over time, but I think our upfront filter of sort of, is that company and those executives, are they going to be around in 10 years? Are they really going to, do they understand the fortitude of what it takes even for the PR side, right? Because a lot of them, look, they have businesses to run, which I get, but to even go out and tell your story, that's effort. And we respect that can't be the only job of a CEO. So do they have all the goods? You know, to go out knowing that the bar for a story is so high, and is it not, you know, you never want to overhype. So what do they have ready and to go now, where we can also paint a little bit of a vision of what's next? And once you have all those things, usually the audience is, to your point of, you know, where to go tell that, it's pretty much like, we need help recruiting, we need investor help, and we want to make sure, you know, people know we're open for business. And you're like, okay, got it. We know how to do that.
I see. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask you how you think about category design.
You mean when a company says, and you know, we want to be in a new category, or we are in a new category?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I have an Alex Outcast answer, and then I have an Alex answer. So category creation to me is in a sort of right now, this is Alex, but I have said this to some clients. I think it's kind of an overused thing. It is. I have not seen a brand new busting a whole new category out in a while, and so I think the challenge is when people come and they say that they want that, there actually isn't one. So you just have to be comfortable in making sure you have a very refined business case for why you exist, and a really great way to tell your story, that it makes sense, that people will get it, and it's clear, et cetera. Because
companies that want to, they're not really differentiated? Or
no, it's very hard. I mean, to me, my bar is very high for a brand new category creation. And a lot of times it's like, you know, it feels very made up at the end. We're like, we think we're in this space. And you're like, you know, so we do a lot of work to make sure if there is one that it's, you know, it doesn't feel like a marketing ploy.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. I wish I could come up with a good example. I don't want to name any companies, but it really has to be true category creation. And a lot of people they use that phrase as a, almost like a marketing tagline these days.
Well, hopefully Play Bigger is helping to solve that problem.
Yes.
Category design is the furthest thing from a marketing tagline.
Exactly. Well, and to me, it's sort of, you don't come to for a marketing solve for category. You know, you might need help naming something, but at the end of the day, it's an upfront business.
Yeah, it's a business strategy.
Right.
And a big mistake that a lot of CEOs make that I see is they often put the CMO in charge of category design.
That's exactly.
And not that there aren't great CMO category designers, there are some, but it's got to be the CEO's initiative, because if it's a marketing thing, then to your point, it becomes a tagline or a campaign or,
yes, exactly,
or messaging or whatever else they want to call it. It's not strategic. How do we really get the world to think differently about a problem,
right,
and therefore?
Because that's right. If you are a true category creator, I think what I love, the ones that I think work, you are coming up with something like, let's say, Internet of Things or something. I don't know. You know, the entire industry, you want them along with you. You want to actually build, you know, a platform for others. And the bigger it is, the better it is for you. And that's sort of my lens. It might be old school. And that's different from being a disruptor or disrupting a category, right? You have a whole new way of doing something, or your consumer device has never been seen before, but usually can fit into a space. And it actually helps if it doesn't, you know, to educate somebody on a whole new category is very hard these days, to your point about everything being so busy, and trying to get people's attention. So if you have to spend a lot of time explaining, that's a challenge. So the quicker you can get people there, the better. It doesn't mean it can't be done. So I'm sure people will right now be typing away on their 100 things that they can think of this. This is just for what we see and what I've seen.
Now, a lot of what you do, and tell me if this is wrong, but you help executives, CEOs, founders do and say the right things when there's a camera or there's a microphone in their face. Yes?
Yes. And more and more these days, it's actually... not just that. It's, you know, in employee town halls and meetings, like, you have to really, you're on 24/7.
So if I was new at that, or newer at that, or, you know, maybe myself, who's not new at it, but you think I suck, I don't know, you tell me, but
nice.
How do you media train an executive today?
Well, there's definitely, if it's for pure media, there's definitely a sort of, a great system, which is just experience, right? Which is just bringing them into a room. You make it very real. So the questions shouldn't, you know, I think fake media trainings where you're just like, here's generally how to think about it, and bridging and all those terms you hear thrown at you, unless the person is working with a real business sort of case, that they really get it faster. So we try to always ground it in as much specificity to their business as possible, so it makes sense to them and it seems relevant, and they're like, I get this now. So all those little tips and tricks, you know, we try to give them. And then obviously if there is a very specific interview of which they're working toward, we prep them for that. It's just preparation is the best ticket. A lot of the ones with the red flags are like, I got this, thanks. I don't need any media training. Or I did it once, I'm good, I got it. And you're like, okay, this will not go well. So it is an investment of time and just kind of working through and hearing yourself answer. So obviously the best part is coming up with really great questions and playing that role of journalist our hope is we're always harder. Everyone says that when they media train, you want it to be much harder in the media training than it actually is in the interview.
Now, when I was a CMO, I was a bastard about this stuff. Like, I didn't give a fuck who you were. You could be the chairman of the board or you could be a product manager. But if you were going to go represent the company in the world,
that's right,
your ass was going to get trained. And you,
yeah,
you know, the higher the profile, the more you were going to get trained and the more you were going to prepare. And I found that, you know, it takes a lot to say to a CEO, hey, listen, fuck you. This is going to take 3 hours of training before you go on CNBC, because you're going on CNBC. And they would go, 3 hours of training. I talk to people every day. I talk to investors. I don't give a shit, right? And because they're not used to it. And they don't realize, you know, one of the – I don't know if CNBC still does this. But, you know, some of these places, they shove you in a closet.
Oh, green screen. You don't even know who you're talking to.
You can't see them. There's a giant camera in your face. And all you have are headphones on. And that's a very confronting environment to just be sitting in, never mind have whoever the host of the show is ask you some tough questions about what's going on with your stock or whatever the case may be.
Right, right.
And so it's just good old-fashioned preparation.
It is. And I wish we had more sort of champions inside the company. And we do. A lot of them get it. And if they don't, that's our challenge sometimes where I sort of go, I wish I was inside. You know, it's hard for me. That has been my biggest transition from never being on the agency consultant side my whole career and having to just know that at some point I have to stand down and I'll say what you say and be like, fuck, why aren't you doing this? And then I can't make them do it because I'm not in there. Like, you know, so most of the time we try to make sure there's a you there. And if there's not, then, you know, we just go, okay, we told you, you know, what, great. Have a good time. And then you have to clean up the mess after and, you know. And then there are people like Elon Musk who are out there every day. Just they do their own thing. And I don't know what I would do. He's my good example of like, I don't know what I would do.
I assume he's not a client.
No. And I probably won't be now. No. I think
he's
there's,
just
you know.
Out there saying whatever he wants, whenever he wants.
Yeah. And I think there's great value to that, you know, in some respects because it's fresh. He doesn't feel messaged or any of those things. But I think it can be also hard because there's a lot of work to do. And so when you're constantly, it's the same as what we were talking about when you're constantly having to monitor a Twitter feed and try to clean up after stuff, it just takes the team off the goal of what it is that you want them to do, in my opinion.
Now, how do you think about harnessing the whole company? Because in the 12 years since I've been a CMO, there's been a massive change in social media. And so today, if you're at a 5,000-person company or a 500-person company, whatever it is, every one of your employees has Twitter accounts and LinkedIn accounts and Facebook and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so you can actually harness – if you're doing a big product launch, you could harness the whole company to go do all that stuff. But to your point, at the same time, now you're asking – everybody in the company to take, you know, our marketing and amplify it, and therefore they're going to engage with the world about whatever it is, and all of a sudden you have 5,000 people, and you know, you as the PR counsel, or me in my old role as a CMO, it's like, holy shit, now we got all these people, right? It's very different from the world that, you know, certainly I grew up in, and I think that you grew up in. And so how do you think about that side of it?
Well, I thank you for bringing that up because this to me is the most interesting transition that I have loved to see. Because I do think the more power you can give to your employees, and I know brand ambassadors and sort of overused cheesy word, but they really, that's how they act. And I think it goes so much to what we tell. So if we are working with a new company and the commitment to culture and employee morale and getting people to really be on board early and making sure you don't lose that through your hypergrowth stage and making sure established brands, you know, that you really have scaled and that they are still acting like a small company and speaking to their employees on a regular basis and not just sort of with these big announcements and it doesn't trickle down. That is never more needed than it has again in these last sort of 18 months ish. Because a lot more is being asked of companies by their employees. They demand a lot more, you know, every CEO is pretty much a head of state at this point. And so I think that companies then have to treat their employees with that same respect and you have to be okay knowing that you have to give them the freedom to do it, but you have to think and spend as much time on the internal dynamics of your company as you do outside. So even internal communications as a role used to be like, where like a, I don't know, HR person went to go retire or like was shoved over or something. Right. And to me, it's incredibly mission critical role inside companies. And if you think about it, I remember at GE, we hired this amazing woman we actually renamed the title instead of internal communications. And this was a long time ago, but employee marketing, head of employee marketing. And we got the pool of candidate that came in that was much higher, obviously, obviously. And that person has, you know, moved on to be the CMO of the company. But I think thinking in that way, because I think it is, it's where everything can go wrong for you, you know, and it starts there. So take care of the house first.
It's interesting as a CMO, and sometimes it wasn't necessarily solid line, but I always had a big hand in employee communications. And when I say I, really the marketing function, and investor relations.
Mm-hmm.
So
That's right. The
communication with the street, critical. There's no, in the old days, there was some separation between the world that looked at your stock and the world, then the real world. Of course, that's been gone for a long time. And to your point on the employees, so you need a communications expert that quarterbacks that stuff, even if it's not necessarily in marketing or PR.
Well, who's at least raising their hand and saying, remember this audience, right? And so even if you're not at a big enough company stage where you have an internal employee, you know, comms person, which I understand, I think the culture piece of really, because I'm sure you've come up against this where you're like, you know, someone's leaking stuff and leaks aren't the employee. I mean, yes, it's not great, but leaks happen because of bad morale, where an employee or a partner doesn't feel like they're on your ship. And so to me, the first thing is don't go around looking at phone records and nailing this person. You know, take a much deeper look at inside your company of what's going on and why. Why are they doing this? Why are they leaking like sieves? I mean, I grew up in media companies that were terrible for this, right? I mean, media covering media was like, it's a whole industry in and of itself in New York. And out here, it's sort of that, you know, tech and tech reporters. And you can, you know, people are now, you know, look at Susan Fowler. I mean, amazing things have happened where it's really, it's been employees who have rung a bell. And so if you're not really in tune, even if you're, you know, 5, 10, 15, 30, you know, 100 people, 250, 500, 1,000, really be thinking of it along the way of, you know, because a lot of companies, I think, which I get, you know, again, you have a lot of priorities, but if you put in the time and attention to that early, I think it pays off in spades.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, the one I've always never understood is that people don't get, there's no such thing as an internal communication, right?
Right. Exactly. Well, that's what I mean. The head of state, like everything companies do these days, you know, is you have to pretend that you're everything you say in a meeting, everything you, you know, write in internally that you have to, you have to pretend it could cause a, you know, world war somewhere. So you have to be very conscious of that.
Yeah. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about you if we could.
Sure.
You took over as CEO of really one of the most iconic companies in Silicon Valley. I mean, maybe not to people outside of Silicon Valley, but inside, everybody knew who Outkast, or everybody knows who Outkast is. And, you know, Karen and Margaret were not exactly low profile individuals, far from it. And, you know, I'm glad to say I've known and worked with both of them and admire the shit out of them. They're ass-kicking, unbelievable.
They are.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, no Maureen going all the way back to Blanc and Otis and all that stuff. So anyway, all this gets me to a question, which is you took over from two super iconic founders, one of the most iconic companies in its category in Silicon Valley. What's that like?
It is, you know, first of all, that's sort of how I met them. You know, I was working at Wired Magazine when I moved out here, and Fred Vogelstein is a reporter, and he said, you know, you really I knew nobody. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I didn't know a series D from an A from a seed. I mean, this is just not my world. And he said, you know what, you really should meet these two kick-ass women. You will love them. They will love you. And I thought, great, please. I'd love to meet people. So he introduced me to them. And it took, as they cutely say, a few years. And they would sort of be like, oh, you know, right away, we sort of, you know, it got along. And they would say, what about this role? What about that role? And I was so burned out, to be honest, from my GE life that I just wanted some time. And my Wired gig was a great place for me at that point in my life. So at a certain point they came to me and said, you know, here is the role and this is what we love to still do. And this is what we think you could be great at doing and helping us run the company. And
Did you originally come in as COO? Am I remembering that right?
That's right. I came in as COO and And actually, right before I joined, I mean, my thought, the good news is I had put a lot, I've always made, I feel like, very good, thoughtful choices in my career. And I remember it was sort of pre-lean in, and I came home after that, and I just had my third surprise kid. And I was like, I can't do this job. Hold
on. I can't let you just say that. Just had your third surprise. So were they all surprises?
Well, sorry. No. Well, no. That, I should say the third. Yes. So I was, you know, pushing 40.
Because after three, you would figure out there's a cause to this.
Totally. Right? No, I was one of those women I always used to make fun of. Like, what do you mean? Like, what do you mean you don't have your shit together? So, yes, I just had Theo, who is now 8 and almost 9 this fall. I had two other kids that are older. They're now 17 and almost 14. And so I thought, God, this was the baby that I didn't really get to have, because the older two, I was, you know, working really hard and never really was around. And so I thought, oh, I'm saying no. And then he was like, you're an idiot. You absolutely can do this. You should do this. So I called him back the next day and said, you know what? I think I will. I just would love a summer off. I haven't had a summer off since, you know, 1986. And they were like, yes, fine. So I didn't start to think about a threesome in that way until Margaret called me and said, you know what, I'm going over to Andreessen and Horowitz. And I remember kind of smiling and not freaked out at all, because I was like, you know what, a teeny part of me was getting a little worried of like how the three of us would do this. And then Karen and I, we worked together for 6 months, and then she went inside Facebook. So they're both clients. They've both been amazingly generous to me. But the fear I had, of, you know, it's one thing, I'm not an entrepreneur, so I did not start this company. I was given this beautiful gift of, to your point, of a company that they built and did such a beautiful job with. And so my fear was, don't fuck this up and don't be the person that somehow takes down this brand. And that's a different kind of fear than, am I going to make it, you know, or can we grow this thing? And it was paralyzing at times. It was not an easy first year. Clients didn't know me. I had never been the client. So I had people in my first new business meeting. I literally had someone help me with how I introduced myself. I didn't even know how to be like, I'm Alex Constantinople. I'm, you know, I had to rehearse those few lines about summing up my 20-year career. And it was just ridiculous. Anyway, I survived, mostly from the generosity, because they were really lovely with me and took my calls. Yeah, please.
I'm going to. Would it be fair to say that you didn't feel like you were ready to be the CEO yet? Is that?
I didn't feel like it. But thank you for making me shorten that. Yes, that's exactly how I felt.
I'm just trying to synthesize what you're.
No, you're exactly right. I still look back on that and kind of go, God, I made it through somehow. But it was through a lot of great people here. I've learned so many leadership lessons.
So how do you get yourself ready when you don't think you're ready?
I think it goes back weirdly to the beginning of our conversation with Larry King. I kind of faked it till I made it, and actually acted. I had spent so much time around CEOs and my GE, I have to say, all of that experience came back through osmosis of sort of how to run teams, all that management experience I had of really just building trust with people, getting them to know me, just letting myself out. The minute I stopped pretending to be CEO of Outcast, which was kind of in the beginning months of like very and meetings and, you know, and just kind of like, fuck it, here I am, this is me, we're going to either do this together or we're not. And then of course it's age old. That's when it started to come together.
Why, it's so funny that we just always need to relearn this lesson, right?
We
try to be something because we're anxious and concerned that we're not what we're supposed to be. And so instead of just sort of relaxing and letting ourselves be ourselves and letting ourselves figure it out, we then try to be this thing that we're not. And that leads to us sucking and feeling shitty about ourselves, and probably others who are feeling really shitty about us. And then one day we realize, fuck this. I only have one real option, which is to be who I am and let the
team. And they can fire me.
Right.
Yeah. It's the age old, like, what is the worst? It's asking yourself, which I work, you know, especially with my teenagers. I'm like, okay, let's play out the worst thing that could happen for this. And when you do that, and you're like, oh, okay, fine, they'll fire me. Like, I'll live. Bye-bye. And here I am. So, yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, but for some reason we, you know, I've had massive failure in my life, and at the start of Legends and Losers, I was terrified that I was going to make, you know, a public ass of myself, and it took me a while to remember that I've made a public ass of myself before, And, you know, it didn't kill me. So what the fuck? Well, let's try it again.
Right. Well, our asthma.
We still go to that same place, don't we?
It's so true. I mean, and that is actually hilariously this 4th of July when people are like, what did you do? And I passed, but now I wish I didn't. But they went to see Uncle Drew. And the message, they came home like, that was an amazing movie. I was like, really? And they're like, well, the message was you can't, you won't make 100% of the shots. Wait, you can't make 100% of the shots you don't take. Right. And I was like, ah, that's so true. That's a great movie. I should have seen it. They said it was funny. Anyway, not on my list.
How long have you been the CEO now?
So it will be, 8 years. 8 years this September, I think.
Wow.
It's kind of a blur, but it's been great. And the evolution, one of the things, the reasons we talked and it made sense for me, I thought, to join was they had the vision of sort of the transformation of the agency from sort of a tech PR, you know, firm that they had started very much in a B2B space, and they had already started to evolve into some social and consumer and things like that, and really built out those marketing services. And that's what got me excited, because I do believe every company should have a communications platform of which if you nail that message and position right up top, and then you have the wherewithal to drive it through, you know, media, advertising and branding, social, digital, customer care, if you have it, you know, external affairs, comms, public affairs, blah, blah, blah. And you can push it consistently through all those places. It works so much better. And so the more things we could offer down in that zone, I felt, you know, and they saw that. And that's really what I was brought in to do. And that's been the most fun of the last 8 years, is really build out those services. So having a design studio here, having, you know, a social and digital and content team, making sure that we are able to, when a company says, here's my story, that we can help them tell that. So that I've loved, and they definitely have that vision, and I'm really, you know, now we're sort of looking at what's the vision for the next 10 years. We actually have an offsite next week, and I can't wait for that, because I feel like it's the sort of management consultant innovation space, a little bit what you're seeing for sure of Accenture and Deloitte and all those guys, and why they're buying, McKinsey's buying up design firms, and just the whole world is intersecting. And I feel like for what we do from the strategic side, which is a huge piece of what we offer, is that you do start to get into more of those kinds of projects, which is, you know, if we can be a little more upstream on, you know, yes, brand strategy, but even sort of help in the decision-making. What are the products? What are you going to put out into the world? And then carry it all the way through. I think, you know, certainly we have go-to-market, but if we can go up a little bit, I think that would be fun for us. So that's what we're talking about.
So you're going to be bumping into McKinsey a little more often?
They're not for them to be scared at all. But I do think we do some of that work already. If we're in close with a company, obviously they spend, you know, have millions of dollars, and I've been on the other side of McKinsey projects certainly in my life, and we won't ever do those. There are some things that come in, you're like, that actually is a management consultant. That's sort of what should the company look like? You know, what should we stop, start, continue? You know, what should organizational, how should we scale this? What should we get rid of? You know, if you're really in there with the clients, you know, you can have a say and help them with a lot of that. And sometimes we do at those smaller companies, and I want to be able to do more of that and have more people with that.
So you're going to get that figured out in the next week or so.
I'm going to get right back to you on that.
Awesome. Now, I'm also a little curious. There's an interesting thread, if I understand your career, which is you've worked inside of and had leadership positions inside of brands or divisions inside of mega corporations, be it NBC with GE, or be it Wired with Condé Nast. And of course, Outkast has a parent company.
Yes.
And so what's it like to be the CEO of a company inside a company?
You know, it's historically, the company that owns us is Next 15 Communications, and they are a public company traded out of the city in London. They own, you know, 17 you know, digital agencies, ad agencies, creative shops, comms, et cetera. And in the very beginning, it was sort of their thing is to founders, you know, sell to us, we will not get in your business. We're not WPP, we're not Omnicom. And I came in and I never even met Tim Dyson, who's the CEO, which I always thought, okay, but they are very hands-off. Now that said, over time, there's such a value to having a parent company. And I am such a company girl that I think I very quickly saw the value of, you know, having someone like him with experience. He ran an agency forever. He certainly, now that we want to do some acquisitions and things ourselves, he has a ton of experience in that. So I tend to lean into it more. I'm part of an executive board. So I love it. I feel like that is a nice tie that I'm not totally out on an island. So they've been more involved. They'll give you as much as they need, you know, as you want from them, which I think has been really nice. And I've taken a lot of advantage of that.
So you don't feel like you feel like it's a huge asset as opposed to I got this corporate parent.
I do.
Overlooking everything I do.
That's right. Because, you know, look, when it's hard when you're like, here's my little truck of profits at the end of the year. Bye, money. But I, you know, I get it. And I know, I mean, that's what I mean. Like, I think it helps because I grew up in that environment. Like, you know, the corporate headquarters calls and says, we need you to do X number this year. And by hook or by crook, hopefully not by crook, you're doing it, you know? And that's, I'm a definitely, the company girl thing I think has helped me not be super rebellious in that way and just gone with it.
Well, and I'd be curious if you feel this way. A lot of my CEO friends say this. Doug Merritt was on Legends and Losers a little while ago. And
yes.
I'll paraphrase. He's the CEO of Splunk.
Yes.
Are they a client by chance?
No, they're not.
Well, I can introduce you to him. But anyway, he said something to the effect of, you know, it's stunning, actually, how little power and influence a CEO really has, right? and in his case, like you, he's not the founder CEO, so he's a hired gun the way you are.
Yes.
But it's like, hey, he's the CEO. It's a publicly traded company. There's a board. There's a chairman. There's all these things. But, you know, it reminds me of that old Bob Dylan line. It may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody.
Yeah.
Right.
It's true. I mean, that's the thing. My husband runs Salon Media and he always says, God, it's so great. I don't know if I could ever work for anyone. And I was like, you have a board. You're a public company. Like, what are you talking about? You know, so I think there's always a higher Lord. And it just depends on how you deal with it. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. I don't let it freak me out.
Yeah, no, I think it's very cool that you figured out a way to make it work. And it's obviously very cool of them to sort of allow outcast to be outcast.
Yes.
A very wise thing. Because if everybody had left or the culture had changed, there's no way the company would have continued to be successful. Especially because you know, you had such well known, high profile, iconic founders.
Yeah. I think if they we were just talking about this the other day, if they had stayed, it would have been really hard for me because the culture has evolved over time and we're very different people and leaders. I never messed with the values of excellence, integrity, and balance. To me, those are great. And we lean into the excellence and making sure we're still, you know, hiring amazingly smart, you know, amazing smart people who are committed to delivering excellent work for really great clients. And that is fundamental to their founding principles. I will never mess with that. But I do think, you know, we have a few people who are around during both times and things are different and that's okay too. And I think that's where I got comfortable with, I can't lead like them. I'm not them, you know, literally as humans. So I have to do it my way. And also they were co-founders and co-leaders. And so to have one, we have a management team, but you know, to have one CEO, that's a different model too. And I've sort of just, again, tried to not mind F the way they did it and just move into here's how I am and how I roll and take it or leave it.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. Anything else before we wrap, Alex?
No, I'm so grateful. This was really great. And I appreciate the way you set it up and everything. So thank you. I'm just grateful for the time and chance to talk.
Well, I'm grateful to have one of the most powerful women in PR in Silicon Valley, if not the business world, hang out with
you're so sweet.
You know.
No, I'm just checking out your office. And I love it. Is there a little pan you can give me, or is it all the hot stuff right behind you?
Most of it's behind me. Hold on, I can. Hold on.
All right. Oh, yeah. It's official. That is official and very cool. Well, it's like a little cave.
You know, where we are, and I've gotten to understand this the longer I've been alive, the physical environment we're in makes a huge difference.
It's true. It's true.
And so, yeah, when we started Legends and Losers, we built a real studio and I have like shit here that makes me happy. And I've always had good offices, but like, this one blows everyone away. I got booze right here. You know,
that's an aspiration for me. That is definitely an aspiration.
Well, you don't have booze in your office?
Oh, we do. We have those a bar upstairs. Yes.
No, I mean,
but it's more just my office. Little cozy. I have a little, we have an open, so I'm out with everybody. So I, you know, they hear me yell at the kids and I can't take your trumpet to school and sorry and all that, but I do not have your scene. Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, even when I had real jobs, I always had a bar in my office. Always. You could always
very
come
mad,
to my
none
office
of you.
For a drink. Yeah,
yeah.
I just, you know,
all right.
I
think
thought
it's
that
good.
Was important.
No, it's good. I like it. There's always a Friday right around the next few hours. You'll start to see people trickle upstairs and little rosé all day with their laptop, which is fine by me. Just get it done. Well, have a wonderful weekend. Thank you again for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Alex. You're a huge inspiration.
Okay. I hope really I get to meet you in person. Time. Absolutely.
I hope so. Hopefully soon.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Whew. That was a goodie. If you love this episode as much as I did, why not share it on social media right now? Or if you know somebody who you think would benefit from this conversation with Alex, why not share it with them straight from your smartphone if that's where you're listening? I'm always curious where people are listening. Are you in the car? Have you been you've been out for a nice long run? You've been lifting some weights, doing some squats? Maybe you're doing the dishes, or maybe I like to work in the garden while listening to podcasts. Anyway, wherever you're listening to us, thank you so much. And if you want to have a question answered on Legends and Losers, we're starting to do some more Q&A shows. Fire an email to blackhole@legendsandlosers.com. And also, we have a brand new website. Why not check it out, legendsandlosers.com. And while you're there, subscribe to be on our mail list, and that way you will never miss any of the hilarity. All right. We would like to thank the amazing Outcast Agency at theoutcastagency.com. Equity Directory, the invite-only network of entrepreneurs exchanging talent for equity. Check them out. If you're in the startup ecosystem, get on equitydirectory.com. HarperCollins smash hit instant classic Play Bigger, how pirates, dreamers, and innovators create and dominate markets. It's the book that Big E entrepreneurs read. And speaking of books that I had something to do with, the brand new Niche Down, the number one Amazon bestseller. Thanks so much for making Niche Down number one on day number one of launch. How to Be Legendary by Being Different. Check it out. The amazing people at onelifefullylived.org. They are the nonprofit helping you dream, plan, and live your best life. Check them out, onelifefullylived.org. My friends at Bixen 2, this is Joe and Bix Bixen's company. They help you hack the future to produce the results that you want out into the future. And you can learn more at bixen2.com. The amazing bestseller from my dear friend, Dushka Zapata, multi-time guest. I think she's been on the podcast more than anyone else. Someone Destroyed My Rocket Ship and Other Havoc I Have Witnessed at the Office. You know, if I was going to write a book like that, the subtitle would be And Other Havoc I Have Caused at the Office. Now, are you working long hours? Are you feeling whelmed? Not underly, but overly. Maybe it's time for a new assistant. And have you thought about a virtual assistant? Check out Bottleneck Virtual Assistants at bottleneck.online. Interview Valet. Are you a thought leader? Do you want to be a thought leader? Why not check out interviewvalet.com? This is where thought leaders go to get their podcast representation. They will book you on some of the leading podcasts on the planet. Rapid Media, legendary marketing, media, communications in Australia at rapidmedia.com.au. And speaking of legendary marketing, our dear friend Greg Canty, his business in beautiful Ireland is called Fusion at fusion.ie. Legendary PR, marketing, and graphic design in the beautiful country of Ireland. And the fantastic people at kiva.org. This is the nonprofit helping small e-entrepreneurs get started, get a little boost with microfinance loans. It's a very powerful idea. It's a cool thing to be involved with. Check out kiva.org. All right, I need to remind you that today's information is provided to you solely for informational purpose, and this podcast is the sole property of the Legends and Losers Podcast Network, and we would love you just a little bit extra if you shared the shit out of it. Now, all rights do remain disturbed, and I must warn you, the information contained in this podcast should not be taken without the expressed written content of a medical professional. And this oddcast is provided with the understanding that the creators, producers, and even some guests may have been consuming libations and cannot be considered reliable. Be nice to your sister, support your local communications professional, buy John's crazy socks, tell two people you love about two podcasts you love, don't forget to listen to Joan Jett, and only buy pasture-raised free-range eggs. Thank you, Dandy Candy. I love you, Mom and Dad. And hey, Colin, this oddcast really ties the room together, doesn't it? Today, our deepest apologies go out to Marcus Rust, CEO of Rose Acre Farms. Sorry, Marky, we just ran out of time for you. That's it, my friends. Thank you so much for investing part of your life with us. It means the world to me and everyone involved here at Legends and Losers. And we'll look forward to seeing you soon.